Have you ever wondered how a book becomes a movie?
Or how a movie becomes a musical?
Or how anything is adapted at all?
Join us as we talk about your favorite stories and all the changes that were made along the way.
But more importantly, why? This is Willing to Adapt. Hi, I'm Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
How's it going?
I'm doing good. How about you?
Great. This is our special episode today because you want to tell our listeners why?
Well, we had technical difficulties with the first recording of this.
We did.
Yeah.
So this is our redo.
Yes.
So for our faithful listeners out there, I'm sorry that this took a little longer than usual. Thank you for bearing with us. Glad you're still listening.
Yes.
Hopefully that means that this is a great episode because we get to do it a second time.
Yes.
So if there's a little bit of an inconsistency between this part and the next part, that might be why.
Correct. Yes.
All right. Would you like to tell our listeners today what we're talking about?
Well, tonight, or today, we're talking about Twelfth Night.
Mm-hmm.
Or
What You Will.
What You Will by William Shakespeare.
What You Will.
What You Will. Yes.
By William Shakespeare. Yes. This is our second time talking about Shakespeare. Last time we talked about his comedy, Much Ado About Nothing, which was a lot of fun.
I enjoyed that one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you're interested in hearing a bit more about William Shakespeare, please go back and listen to our previous episode where we go much more in-depth about him. We're only going to have a cursory knowledge about him today because we've already talked about him.
Correct.
So, Romy.
Yes.
When is the first time you were exposed to this play?
For, of course, like for many things, yep. For this podcast.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
And you enjoyed it.
I did. Yeah. In fact, this is the first time up until the point when you suggested it, I had never heard of it.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, so it, interestingly enough, it was...
And then all of a sudden you're seeing it everywhere. Everyone's talking about Twelfth Night.
Funny enough, I actually have.
Really?
It's weird, yeah. I don't know why, but it's popped up in a couple of things. Maybe because now I'm actually...
You're exposed to it.
That, and it's probably in my algorithms now.
Google's sending you things.
Pretty much. They've been listening to me.
They're listening.
Is that, oh my gosh, that was weird.
They are listening. For those out there, Romy's phone started talking to him because we said Google.
I forget I have a Samsung. It never works when I try
it. I've turned all of mine off. I won't let it talk to me.
I don't know how to.
I don't think the listeners heard your phone. They just heard us freak out.
They might have heard a little bit in the background. I'm a Luddite, so I'm not really good at...
I'm also a bit of a Luddite.
Yeah.
I have a healthy respect for technology, but I think we've gone too far.
Yep.
All right. For you folks out there, William Shakespeare is probably one of the most prolific English writers in the world. He's been translated to basically every language. And this is definitely probably one of the more popular plays by him, although it's obviously not one that is commonplace in every household, like Romeo and Juliet.
Mm-hmm.
Or even Hamlet. I think most people know of Hamlet.
Yeah.
I was aware of this play only because I grew up doing theater. And a lot of colleges like to do Twelfth Night, which we'll talk about why. Part of the reason is the gender roles and the flexibility they're in in this play. But I was really exposed to what we watched for this podcast episode because of a class I took at Cal Poly Pomona. And it was interesting. It was taught by a very liberal professor who was a lovely woman. I loved her. She was great. But definitely had an angle in the class, for sure. And so we'll talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
So we watched the Globe version.
Yes, we did.
From, what, 2007? Something like that?
Something like that.
Yeah. It was performed at the Globe, and it was performed as close as possible to how they would have performed it back in Shakespeare's day. And so it had all men only in the cast, and they created the costumes and set pieces and everything according to how they would have from the best of their knowledge. And the other one that we watched was the 1996 film version directed by Trevor Nunn, and it has Helena Bonham Carter and Imogen Stubbs and many, many other people.
Correct.
And, of course, you had not watched either of those until this podcast episode.
No, I hadn't. Yeah.
I appreciate the amount of trust that you have built in in me because of everything we've gone over.
I think I've liked almost everything we've done except
yes,
one of our future coming ones, but oh. We'll talk about that another time.
Uh-oh. I know what it is.
But okay. No, but the Shakespeare stuff, even though it's hard to read, it's enjoyable. Because of, especially reading it out loud.
Yes, yes. The key to Shakespeare, like we've said before, is you need to watch or listen to a production where they really understand what he's saying and are able to really evoke all the emotions properly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's you can understand what they're saying even if you don't understand what each of the words mean.
Mm-hmm. No, that's true. I saw a video on YouTube. It was a comedy sketch in Ink from England, and it was a bunch of famous actors, and they were all saying to be or not to be. And it was interesting because each one that came out emphasized a different word, which made it completely different.
To be or not to be.
Yeah.
To be.
Yeah.
And that seems like some weird, like, theatrical exercise that we would do.
It was funny, though, because especially who all the people were, from Dame Judi Dench to David Tennant. So it was a bunch of different people. But I find it's kind of like when you're reading a translated work, like in this case, Anna Karenina, which is a book we're currently going through. It's interesting because when you read a different translator's version, there's differences.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely differences.
Especially if it's in a different language.
Yeah. And so when I'm watching either a play or the movie, there can be, especially with Shakespeare or any type of work of art where it's especially in theater, like a ballet, when we talked about that, and how there can be from one show to the other. Like in my mind, prior to my exposure to ballet, I thought they're all the same. I thought the Nutcracker was the same. You know, I thought every ballet company did the Nutcracker the same every year.
Like, oh God, it's so boring.
yeah, that's kind of how I thought of it.
Copy and paste.
And in many ways, not to say that theater is anything like that. It's not that varied in how they perform it, but there is some variation.
Yeah, and it depends on who's doing it. And
yeah, and especially being able to see it done as Shakespeare would have done it.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah,
and I can't remember if we talked about this. If I'll talk about this in the next episode.
What?
But the variation in whether it was a comedy or a drama.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So, do you want me to give a little backstory?
Go ahead.
Okay. The play was probably finished between 1600 and 1601. It's a period suggested by the play's referencing of events that happened during that time. And the full title of the play is Twelfth Night, or What You Will, as you said. Subtitles apparently for plays were very fashionable in the Elizabethan era. And what's interesting is this play takes place very late in his life. And that's there was only three more plays that he wrote after this.
Okay.
And so he had a wealth of experience prior to writing this one. So I think that definitely contributes to him because he definitely has tropes, I would say.
Yeah.
And I think he really kind of perfected on a lot of them by the time he got to this one.
Okay.
In my opinion, at least. Would you like me to give my synopsis?
Go ahead. I don't have one.
Yeah, well, it's the one I did last time. we got really excited because it was the Folger Shakespeare Library.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Which like you edition. Like.
Mm-hmm. So the translations.
Twelfth Night. It's an allusion to the night of festivity preceding the Christian celebration of the Epiphany. It combines love, confusion, mistaken identities, and joyful discovery. And as the story goes, after the twins, Sebastian and Viola, survive a shipwreck, neither knows that the other is alive. Viola goes into service with Count Orsino of Illyria, disguised as a young man named Cesario. Orsino sends Cesario to woo the Lady Olivia on his behalf. But Olivia falls in love with Cesario. Viola, in the meantime, has fallen in love with Orsino. At the estate of Lady Olivia, Sir Toby Belch, Olivia's kinsman, has brought in Sir Andrew Aguecheek to be her suitor. A confrontation between Olivia's steward named Malvolio and the partying Toby and his cohort leads to a revenge plot against Malvolio led by Olivia's housekeeper, handmaiden, I don't know, Mariah. Malvolia is tricked into making a fool of himself, and he is locked in a dungeon as a lunatic. In the meantime, Sebastian has been rescued by a sea captain named Antonio. When Viola, as Cesario, is challenged to a duel, Antonio mistakes her for Sebastian, comes to her aid, and is arrested. Olivia, meanwhile, mistakes Sebastian for Cesario and declares her love. When finally Sebastian and Viola appear together, the puzzles around the mistaken identities are solved. Cesario is revealed as Viola, Orsino asks for Viola's hand, Sebastian will wed Olivia, and Viola will marry Count Orsino. Malvolio, blaming Olivia and others for his humiliation, vows revenge.
Very good synopsis.
I was very happy I found this one. It could have taken a long time to get through this. First thoughts. Yes, in this redo.
My first thoughts are really just in regards to thinking back to watching, because I watched the play first, and then the movie, and I think a lot of it was, because as I'm watching it, it's portrayed as a comedy.
Yeah, the Globe version?
The Globe version, And so, actually, before I even watched it, I started listening to an audio version. After starting the audio book or, version of it, and then jumping over to the Globe production, there's so much more in the visual that you miss.
Because
there was a lot
There's so much more that there can be.
There can, yes. And in this case, I don't know why I miss how I missed it, but I remember thinking back to it, and I was surprised at how much I missed in just listening to the audio. Because when I went back and watched the Globe version, all of a sudden I'm thinking to myself, wow, when did that happen? When did they? I vaguely remember them talking about something, and even some of the things that they talked about, because I didn't have a visual. Because remember, Shakespeare's so, the English is so old, a lot of archaic words. I think I misinterpreted what was going on.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of glad I read it, watched it, or listened to it first, and then filled in the blanks afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's definitely a big difference between the Globe version and the version from 96.
Oh, yeah.
And do you want to talk about just the Globe version first, and then we'll move on? So one of the best benefits from the Globe version, I think, is the fact that it's played by all men.
Okay, yeah.
And that's because of the nature of the play. And so the play itself originally was intended for all actors who were men. And so when you have the mistaken identity, when the sisters pretend to be a man and all that stuff, and then it's like, who's who? You can get away with it a lot better when all the actors are men.
Yeah.
Because it's one, you're suspending their disbelief more.
Yeah.
It works really well. And in the Globe version, you very quickly forget they're all men.
You do, in a certain, from a certain perspective. I think I had a hard time with Viola. Yes. That one I had a hard time disbelieving, but like with the maid or the queen.
Oh, sure.
And the queen, the countess. Yeah. Well, yeah. That one
the
was
actor
easier.
Who played Mariah was really funny.
She was, yes. And and it's interesting because I think today when I've seen people portraying different, like men dressing as women and portraying characters, it's done very differently. For different reasons. And we have a whole different context behind it today in today's society.
Oh, for sure.
And so in watching it and knowing that this was how it was done, but I believe it was done because it was outlawed for women to be in theater, correct?
Yes, true.
Okay.
Yeah, women were not allowed to be on the stage legally. It still happened periodically, but it was not legal until the reign of Charles II.
Okay, so Civil War roughly time?
It was after.
After the Civil
right
War.
After. Yeah.
After the.
Because they brought Charles II back.
Okay.
When he was. Because, long story short, when they executed Charles I.
Yes.
Charles II was living in France.
Correct. Yeah.
And so he brought a lot of French traditions back to England. And one of the many, many ones was bringing women onto the stage.
Okay.
Because women were acting in France.
Okay. That makes sense. The all-male cast, it leans more to comedy.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And so I think in certain ways,
And it still has gravity to it, though.
It does. It does. I think it would have been better, though, had I watched it after I saw the movie.
Oh, sure. Yeah. 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 And for me, that actually was the case. Because mm-hmm. when I was in my class and I knew that I had to watch Twelfth Night, mm-hmm. I first watched the 96 production.
Okay.
And then later on watched the Globe version because we were required to watch that one. And so when I watched the 96 version, I just watched it because I just wanted to be familiar with the play. And I read it, but I wanted to watch it and be familiar. And it looked really interesting. One, because it's set in the Victorian period, mm-hmm. which I was really interested. I really like. And then it had some big actors in it that I knew. So
yeah. Yeah.
And the trailer looked cool. I find that usually a lot of period movies made in the 90s are really entertaining. Even if they're not like always the most accurate, like I think they're generally well done.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think a lot of them were.
I don't know what it was about the 90s, but. Mm-hmm. But yes, the Globe version, they did a great job, and they did a good job with little.
Yeah.
Because like there were some costume changes, but the scenery was very minimal, mm-hmm. and they do a great job of changing the scenery by just moving a bench or mm-hmm. moving some shrubbery or something. And you know exactly where you are, but yeah, that's why I like it.
And the singing interludes in between scenes were interesting.
A lot of people forget that Shakespeare's plays, when they were written, the going to the theater is very different than now.
Yeah.
Now it's almost like a solemn thing. Mm-hmm. Like there's cheering sometimes still and applauding, obviously, but back then, it was almost like a festival. Like you would go, and there would be people out in the stalls down below, like selling their wares. And people would be eating and throwing things and laughing. And and like the people who had more money would pay more and like have a seat somewhere on the side. And maybe mm-hmm. if they paid extra, they'd have a cushion.
Oh, wow. You know?
But it was definitely a thing. And the goal was to keep people entertained because the audience could turn on them.
Oh, okay.
And so that was why it's not uncommon for some of the crazy things to happen in his play, but it's also not uncommon to have singing and thing in his plays because it's one more thing to make the audience entertained.
Mm-hmm. But it was more of an interpretation that they did because it's not part of the script as far as I know, at least the script I read.
It's not uncommon to have songs in the plays.
Yeah.
I can't remember. Well, like Feste has songs that he sings.
He had some that he sang, but like there was the ones where they all kind of march out in the middle while they're in between the scene and they all sing a song together as a group and then they march backwards back behind the doors.
Yeah, that I don't know.
Because I remember, the only reason I remember is because my wife was watching it. We were watching it together and she ran and grabbed my script copy to make sure to follow along.
Like, she's like flipping through the pages. She's like, this isn't here.
And it was funny. Well, funny enough, she did that with the 96 one. She did actually looking around to see, I don't remember that. Or was that in there?
Yeah.
But when they came to the singing part, she's like, was that in there? So she opened it up and it wasn't. It was in between two scenes or two acts. I can't remember. So, but it was cool. I loved what it brought to the show. Mm-hmm. And I kind of assumed it was something that would have harkened back to that era or that time.
Yeah, as best as we know.
Yeah. And or at least the songs were from that time is what I'm assuming.
Well, and they played on instruments they had.
Exactly. Yeah, that too was kind of cool, watching them up at the top.
Yes.
And so...
It's funny, though, to think because the seats up top mm-hmm. where the band was...
Yeah.
Like, that would be where you could have a seat back in the day.
I kind of wondered if those were people around them that on the sides up there with them.
Yes, but, like, the one, like, above, like, that would have been, like, if someone of high importance came to the theater, like, they would sit there all the audience could see them.
Mm-hmm. That's funny.
And so, like, you'd literally be looking, like, at the back of all the actors, but it's because you want to be seen, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is what boxes and theaters all used to be like anyway. Like, mm-hmm. they're not the best view... usually, but you want to be seen.
Correct. So, yeah. The more you know. Cool. It was cool though. I liked how they did that. And I know you had mentioned that they don't do that anymore, unfortunately.
At the Globe, it's possible they might still occasionally mm-hmm. try to be as accurate as possible. But a lot of what I've seen lately is it's almost like seeing a play anywhere else.
Okay.
It's just another venue, it seems like.
Yeah.
And So, like, they have women playing in the roles now, and, the costumes and sets are kind of weird and whatever. It's more modern now, but I think part of that, I think the novelty kind of fell away. And I think, I can only suppose what happened, so I don't know. My imagining is that they just needed actors, and the women were angry they couldn't be in it, and I don't know.
Probably. It usually is from the necessity of the forces of the market.
For sure.
Or of society. Both tend to play major roles.
Well, and you automatically have a bigger pool of actors when you can just let anybody do it.
Correct. So.
But Twelfth Night is interesting, and part of the reason why I chose it is because it can go in very many directions.
Mm-hmm.
Automatically, this production can be very comedic, or it can be very tragic in a way.
Yeah.
Very dramatic. And you'll see that when we talk about the 96 production, but the Globe is definitely much more comedic.
Mm-hmm.
And the 96 production is much more dramatic. Actually, it cuts almost a lot of the comedic moments out.
Yeah.
But I don't know exactly, and nobody knows exactly what Shakespeare intended. He usually does a very good balance of both.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it just depends on how you want to portray it, I think.
Is it classified officially as a drama or as a comedy?
It's classified, mind you, this is like, I don't know what classically it would have been classified today it's classified as a romantic comedy.
Romantic comedy, okay. Yeah.
And today it's a very popular production because of the themes of like gender fluidity and gender confusion and things like that. I don't think we need to dive too much into that because I think our audience is wise enough to know exactly what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are definitely people out there who will take this play and will put their own spin on it and say things that I may not agree with. But if you're putting your play on and you want to put a spin on it, that's up to you.
Yep.
But we'll talk about what you and I think about this play when we go a bit more in depth.
Okay, cool.
Do you want to hear something a little interesting that I came across on Reddit, of all places?
Sure. I didn't know you go to Reddit.
I don't. I stumbled onto it. Someone named Take Off Your Mask said, "Noob here. I simply could not get through Twelfth Night. Why is this so popular?" And then they went on to explain. They tried to watch a couple different versions, and they said, "It just wasn't funny. I don't get it." And he found it insufferable and blah, 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 right?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody named Sima_Hui, they gave a response, and I'll jump ahead a little bit. And they said that it's one of their favorites, and they've been in it multiple times. They said, "Firstly, the play is a wonderful ensemble piece. Although we tend to think of Viola as the lead, nearly every character has significant input into the world and moments of both humor and drama, depending on the interpretation. The show can quickly shift focus and become about a different protagonist. This was certainly the case, as we were talking about, in the Globe's seminal production, in which Mark Rylance's performance made the story clearly about Olivia. I've also worked on production very focused on Feste and how he relates to the world of the play." And they said, "Secondly, and most significantly, although it is a comedy, the play is built upon a much more solemn foundation than most other comedies." They said they posted previously about themes of grief, and they said, "And particularly, you can find themes of grief in Shakespeare's play after the death of his only son, Hamnet." Twelfth Night begins not only with Sebastian and Viola left to assume that their only family member has died traumatically, but also establishes quickly that Olivia's entire household is in deep mourning for the sudden and unexpected deaths of two family members. It's easy to glide over these circumstances, and many productions, in performing a quote-unquote comedy, forget to maintain them. Crucially, we must remember that Viola and Sebastian's actions are conducted while not being given the time to process their own grief. Sebastian eventually confides in Antonio briefly, but then moves on, lest the pain be too unbearable. Viola, requiring a disguise, is unable to confide in anyone, and is left to carry the burden of loss alone. In the Olivia household, grief again dictates much of the dynamics. Olivia was never supposed to run a household. She has a whole group of people who are now suddenly dependent on her and her good leadership. While she assumed that her father and brother would always fill this role, just running the day-to-day affairs is exhausting in how it reminds her of their absence. Malvolio, although over the top, is a welcome assistant in assuming some of these responsibilities. Finding himself suddenly favored, Malvolio indulges his own vanity, adores his new relevance, and seeks to protect it. But the grief doesn't stop with Olivia. Our first encounter with Toby is of him drunk, loud, and railing against Olivia's insistence on mourning openly. Remember that it was Toby's brother and nephew who both died suddenly. There's no reason not to assume that this loss affected him as well, and resorting to alcohol to self-medicate is not an unrecognizable behavior even today. In the same way Hamlet dwells on his grief while Gertrude ignores hers, so too does Toby, and Olivia's constant reminders of their loss is making Toby's denial difficult to maintain. Toby's antics aren't just quote-unquote funny pranks, they are attempts to drown out the grief with revelry. Andrew is essential to this effort, and any threat to leave on his part sends Toby into desperate measures to keep him around. It's also no coincidence that the pranks performed are targets at Malvolio, the person who is openly encouraging Olivia to indulge in her grief. The last part of the theme of grief, I'll mention, they say, is how it relates to Feste. He is an enigmatic character whose connection to others is always a bit aloof. He's like a jester, a fool. I don't know if we've said that or not. We know he disappeared before the play begins, at a time presumably after Olivia's dad and brother died. Why? No answer is given, but it's clear Olivia is not happy about it. I make some assumptions here, but if Hamlet's attitude towards Yorick is any indication, for a young Olivia, the household fool could have been a source of joy, comfort, and even perhaps surrogate fatherhood. To lose him at the time would be deeply upsetting to her. On the other side, if Feste loses his patron, the heir presumptive of the house, and then sees Toby, the elder and friend, descend into drunken denial, it would likely be pretty unclear what Feste's relevance in the household was, particularly if he was dealing with grief of his own. Fleeing the situation to process might have been the reflex reaction, and returning to the household becomes about learning how to reintegrate into a changed environment. Over the course of the play, Feste fails to form any close connection. Being included briefly in the Malvolio antics but then fading into the background, his relevance and utility have come to an end. Life has progressed, the generation he belongs to has aged or died, and the focus of the world is now on the children he once amused. Recognizing himself as an afterthought, he is left to observe on how any individual must eventually be forgotten, just as Jacques so famously observes in his immortal All the World's a Stage speech. Third and lastly, in spite of all the grief, the play ends on a note of imperfect hope. Some lost family members are miraculously returned from the dead, while others are not. Some people enjoy good fortune, while others are treated unfairly. Is Malvolio reasonably punished or unjustly bullied? Is marriage to Orsino and Olivia and Mariah likely to be joyous or untested? Is Andrew openly scorned after showing loyalty? We are left with hope, but also uncertainty, optimism, but also caution. You said you find the characters insufferable, they say, and I'd be wary of anyone who said they adored everything about the characters. They are flawed, many damaged, healing, and trying to move forward with hope. Whether they will succeed is up to speculation. There you go, it's a lot. What do you think?
I think it was well said. I think, for me, I'm more trying to struggle with getting into the mindset of someone who would not see that, which may come up in the next podcast.
Well, a lot of I have learned as I've gotten older that a lot of people take things at face value.
Correct. I get that because I take poetry at face value because I'm working on that.
Oddly enough, poetry sometimes actually just needs to be taken at face value.
True. Maybe, I don't know, maybe that's another subject, I guess, for another time. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, though, if it was more just the fact that he's watching something that's a little more archaic and cultured?
I have no idea.
Yeah. The reason I'm thinking about that is everyone was all excited about the new, it's a part two, and an Adam Sandler movie coming out, Happy Gilmore 2 or something.
Really?
Everyone has been excited about this part two coming out. And then they'll ask me, oh yeah, you know, I love his movies, blah, blah, blah. Which one's your favorite? And then I'll have to respond with the classic Romy response of, I've never watched any of his movies with the exception of Waterboy. And the only reason I saw Waterboy was because the Star Wars Episode 1 trailer was playing before it. And that was when it was first released, the trailer, before the movie came out. Otherwise, I never would have gone. And for most people...
That's so specific.
It is. And so, I don't know why it had to be with that movie, but it did. The movie was fine. It was a comedy, but I'm not someone who is very... I can appreciate comedies, but for the most part, a lot of contemporary comedies,
He's also a very specific type of humor.
He is. And it's not something I'm going to put on and watch. It's kind of like when people watch Elf every year. If it's on, great, I'll watch it. It's a good movie. I have nothing against it, but I'm not one of those people who... I'd rather watch It's a Wonderful Life or... what's the other one? Miracle on 34th Street every year, which is what I do.
Sure. But that idea of... the underlying grief I've thought about, but they're correct in that a lot of people just kind of glance over it and they forget about it.
Yes.
But the 12th Night actually has a lot of grief in it.
So going back to the person who couldn't appreciate it, do you think it's because they're taking it at face value when it's something that should not be? Because like the author was saying of that Reddit post.
I don't imagine understand why they don't understand. Yeah, don't like
people,
it, but
people in general. Because I know a lot of people who would never watch a Shakespeare.
I think anything. A lot of people, especially when it comes to comedies, mm-hmm. the vast majority of people need to be spoon-fed.
They
take the low-hanging fruit.
Yes. I think you've edited a lot of my comments about that. Yes, go ahead.
And so... there, that's my
okay.
My, that's
no, what I'm going to say sense. On that. And so, yeah, and I think, and it's funny because even being someone who tends to analyze movies more than I think sometimes their directors even intend for me, some person to do so.
Depends on the director.
That's true. That's very true. And
some director out there's like, oh, thank God, Romy's thinking about this.
Because people always tell me, like, wow, you saw so much in that movie. They're like, I just thought it was funny. I'm like, oh, yeah, well. Unfortunately, sometimes it ruins movies for me.
And you're like, why did you think it was funny? This was a tragedy, you know?
But I agree with, I like when, I do appreciate though the way other people can view things and see things. Because I'll be honest, I kind of glossed over the death as well. I don't think the Globe version really brings it up.
No, not in...
I think the movie, the 96 one does.
The 96 version definitely. Does a great job
yes.
of returning to those moments of grief and... Mm-hmm. And sadness and not despair, but almost confusion and like hopelessness mm-hmm. at no, times.
Mm-hmm.
And the music helps.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was beautifully done for the music on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think some of the questions I've had about some of the characters were answered in that analysis, actually.
Because
I was always confused as to why Sir Toby wanted to keep Andrew around so much. But that argument makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that Toby is heavily drinking to distract himself from all this grief, and he wants to party so that he doesn't have to think about his emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has Andrew around just to toy with him a bit, but also to bring some levity to the household and to mess a bit with Olivia.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes a lot of sense that he wanted to keep him around because it's somebody to help distract him.
And even for me makes the final dismissal of Andrew even more poignant.
Yeah.
Because I know for me that I felt especially in the Globe version, I thought he was like being super harsh with him.
Sure.
Compared to the movie version wasn't quite as harsh. And I actually felt pity for him.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I always felt really bad for Antonio, the captain who saved Sebastian.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. I always felt very bad for him. In the play, you find out he was like a pirate at one point, and so he's afraid of being in Illyria because people there know him and he can be in trouble from his pirating days.
Yeah,
but he like befriended Sebastian because he saved him, and so. Psychologically, I think when you save someone, you feel this connection to them and vice versa sometimes. And
yeah.
You want to look after them, and it's almost like a fatherly figure at times or like a brotherly figure, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I have found, and in my class we talked about this, I have found a lot of people, for one reason or another, like to make Antonio into like somewhat of like a character who is in like a weird homoerotic relationship with Sebastian.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah. Which I get why they want to go there, mm-hmm. but I also disagree with that.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people get really tripped up by the language of Shakespeare. Because Shakespeare will, he'll put in the mouths of his characters like two men talking to each other and he'll say, my love for you is blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Which modern audiences hear that and they're like, oh, oh wow, these two men, you know, stuff like that. But I don't know why I went that way, but that was the one, that was kind of the way people would talk though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, we've talked about this before on the podcast, but, you know, the genders, within the genders, we were a lot more intimate with each other back in the day. And obviously there's been a spectrum, and obviously, you know, there have always been, you know, homosexuals and, like, that's, people are people and, you know, whatever. But I think a lot of people, like we've said, put too much focus on specific themes when it doesn't necessarily need to be there.
I don't know if it's the over-sexualization as much as the hyper-sexualization of our current contemporary culture. Because if you look, one of the things that's, for me, amusing to research and read through is the, when you start researching even Victorian, Edwardian, and Middle Ages, you realize that in the general populace, or Rome, Greek, sexuality and sexual themes were natural and, or were part of everyday life. Always found
graffiti, even when we were reading Anna Karenina, like there's some chapters where it will talk about some sexual themes and you know what they're talking about, but it's not in your face.
Correct. Yes. And but I think it's changed for today. It's not, so it's not so much that
we've
never
very
been there.
Graphic.
Yes. And I think it's become overindulged in every medium and in every area and expected to be normal. It's been normalized.
Well, it's been normalized, but then it's built on each other because there are no, there's no gatekeeping anymore, especially with things like streaming and things like that, where, like, when it was, when things are on television, they would abide by certain codes and things, but now, especially with, like, anything online and with streaming and things, those things almost just don't exist.
Yeah.
Almost. And so you, their standards are, have definitely changed. And
but I think it's the desire to be realistic. We have to be realistic, or we have to show what's inside of us, and we have to be blunt about it, versus when we look at how Shakespeare, or even in, like you mentioned, Anna Karenina, it's, we all know what they're talking about, we all know what's going on, and it sometimes can be tongue-in-cheek. And that adds to the charm of the piece, because it's not in your face, you know?
Yeah, but I find that when you engage in, especially fiction, when you engage in fiction that promotes a specific thing or is very graphic or whatever, like when it really pushes a specific aspect, all of a sudden people are thinking, this is normal.
Yeah.
And so then it bleeds into reality, and I don't like that.
Yeah. No, I agree. There's an author I really enjoy, and I listen to his podcast, and he talks about the difference between, it's basically when he talks about horror and how he, or
when he talks about horror.
So he talks about horror novels, horror novels.
Horror novels.
Yes, am I saying it wrong?
I thought you were saying he talks about horror novels.
No, horror. It's my Spanish accent, my ghetto accent. Just kidding.
Can you just roll your R's?
Yes. That was bad. And anyway, so he'll talk about how he loves reading or watching movies where, like, for instance, like Hitchcock, you know, where it's implied or where you know what they're talking about and what's going on, but it's not overly graphic. And to him, a lot, slasher films, he hates slasher films. One, because there's no story, or it's a simplistic, just generic story.
Sure.
And two, you're there for the jump scares or the gratuitous violence, basically.
Yeah.
And as an author, to him, he's introduced, like, there's that one about the monkey's paw. Yep. I know he read that story and he talked about it and other ones. And he'll even talk about Stephen King and other, how they are able to use that. And that's, I know both of us tend to gravitate towards artists or authors or whoever who can bring that out without being over your head blunt.
I like it when people can be clever and artistic in a way that it's not in your face.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And especially being Shakespeare being older, it takes even more of
a little
of a chore sometimes to figure things out. But I don't know about you, but I don't have to understand the words that are coming out of their mouth, not to quote Rush Hour. But it's you just by watching it, you know what pretty much what they're talking about and what's going on.
If you pay attention.
If you pay attention, yes.
Well, I think we should jump to the film adaptation.
All right.
And then we can talk about the differences.
Cool.
Would you like me to give a short background on the film?
Go ahead.
Again, called Twelfth Night. It's a romantic comedy film adaptation directed by Trevor Nunn, and it features an all-star cast. Set in the late 19th century, it was filmed on location in Cornwall. It stars Helena Bonham Carter, Richard E. Grant, Nigel Hawthorne, Ben Kingsley, Mel Smith, Imelda Staunton, Toby Stevens, and Imogene Stubbs. And I didn't know this at first, but Trevor Nunn, who is the director, he is an English theater director and lyricist.
Hmm.
He has been the artistic director for the Royal Shakespeare Company, the Royal National Theater, and currently the Theater Royal Haymarket. And he's directed many Shakespeare plays, and as well as opera and musicals, such as Cats and Les Miserables.
Hmm. Interesting.
Which I did not know.
I did not know that either.
Makes me like him now. He's been nominated for many Tony Awards and other other things.
Okay.
That's all I wanted to say about him.
Cool. It was a good movie.
Yes.
It was. It was different.
Yes.
A lot more serious. Mm-hmm. So more of a drama, less of a comedy. But there were comedic parts. And the costumes were very beautiful.
Oh, I loved them.
And
I loved it.
Even the camera work, from the background shots, the scenery to, I don't know. I really enjoyed watching it. The acting was good too. Not quite as up. I would say not on par with some kind of what I expected for some of the actors, I will.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of that is in the directing though.
Okay.
I mean, you got a good director and they can bring out whatever they want in the acting.
Yeah.
They can get you there. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, particularly Ben Kingsley.
You think he didn't do as good as he could have been?
He felt
a little flat.
Yeah.
I think it's difficult because the character of a fool, when you adapt to a different time period, you have to figure out what that's going to look like. Because a bard-like character, especially one that's supposed to be like a fool, doesn't translate very well into late Victorian period.
That's true.
It works fine for Shakespearean time, because that still happened.
Yeah.
Even though in the story it's set in a fictional country called Illyria, which is the name of a very ancient kingdom, and Shakespeare did that a lot. And he liked to do stuff like that because it would help the audience suspend their disbelief a lot and make it more fun. But because the character Feste, played by Ben Kingsley in the film, it never really quite got a grasp on what he was.
Yeah.
No. Like, he just felt like a weird homeless traveler who played instruments and sang. And
that's pretty much what he was.
I mean, that's kind of what bards were, but I don't know. It was weird.
It just didn't work as well as it did.
He felt a little flat.
It did. Yeah. Yes. And I
don't know if that was just they were trying to go with more of that serious nature. Or
maybe. Yeah.
They definitely made him the narrator, which was a choice. And he opens the film with his narration, which is brand new for this.
Yeah, it was. Because thinking back to other movies or other things I've watched where usually this random homeless guy or random who ends up also being the narrator kind of adds that. It's that overarching person who knows everything that's going on. He's able to kind of help the audience piece things together. But I think because that's not how Shakespeare originally created him to be. But I think maybe that's what they were trying to do in this movie. It didn't quite translate as well.
Do you want to jump into some of the differences first?
Sure.
Or do you want to talk about just the film in general first?
Actually, let's talk about the film in general first. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Tell me.
Yes.
Did you like the film? I know you said you wish you watched it before you watched the Globe version.
Yes, I wish I did. I did like the film. I did. I appreciated the additional stuff that was added in. At first it threw me off a little, but then once I realized what they were doing, the brother and sister, okay, it made sense. And adding context to the shipwreck,
they added some context, and then I think it helped that they showed Sebastian in the beginning.
Yeah,
because you don't meet Sebastian in the play until like halfway through.
It, also having the soldiers kind of look for survivors added a little gravitas to the whole idea of being in a foreign country where they were not supposed to be.
Right. Well, they introduced the concept that they're not allowed to be in that country because they hail from a country that's at war with Illyria, which is not in the original play. The film adaptation, for its credit, adds a lot of conflict, which I think makes it more interesting to watch. And it seems to streamline a lot. It definitely cuts out a lot of the funnier bits.
Yeah.
And it felt more realistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did.
And it felt as if, in the original play, there's a lot of moments you watch it and you're like, this doesn't feel like it could be very real, but it's fun to watch anyway. Mm-hmm. And because it's a play and all the other things, like, you just go with it and you don't care. But for a film, because you don't suspend your disbelief as much in a film.
Correct, yeah.
And so you usually have to either lean into the fantastical stuff or you have to pull back and make it more realistic.
Mm-hmm. I thought it did that very well. Even by changing the time period to when it was kind of ambiguous, but it did, as you said, was more Edwardian?
No, it looked very late Victorian.
Late Victorian.
Yeah. Like, if I had a guess, I would guess it was probably the 1890s.
Okay, because of the outfits.
The silhouettes of the dresses and the men's costumes and...
Kind of a Russian feel?
No, it felt very Western European.
Okay. Prussian, maybe?
Well, the soldiers' costumes looked very... and in the Wikipedia page, it said that it was modeled after the Austro-Hungarians.
Oh, okay. So the Habsburgs.
Yeah, well, and then Illyria obviously was filmed in England, but it also felt in a way very French too. So,
really, I didn't get that.
Well, with like that kind of seaside country, like French, it felt very like Mont Saint Michel.
Oh, okay.
A little bit. You know what I'm talking about?
Not really.
The island off of France that will get waterlocked.
Yeah. No, I'm not familiar with that island.
I'm not quite sure why he chose that time period. I would have to venture a guess. Can you imagine?
So, just as a casual viewer, I think it's a little more... Okay, if I was going to be selling this as a film...
Sure.
My audience audiences today might be a little bit less likely to go see a movie in the...
1600s?
1600s, yeah. It's very much a period piece in that case. Whereas for here, people have in mind Pride and Prejudice, even though it's not the same thing. But they think that kind of romance and, oh, look at, they have the stately soldier uniforms, and they have the period dresses, but it's not too archaic, too old. And it's a little more accessible to modern audiences, visually wise, to get them to come and see a movie.
Yeah, maybe.
And I also think if I was doing a movie myself or writing a script, I think that also is kind of a cool period when it comes to costumes to scenery.
Yeah.
And it just leans to a bunch of different reasons.
Well, in the Victorian period, did a lot of throwback to different time periods, like in the medieval period. And you even see that in Olivia's costume at one point when she starts falling in love with Cesario.
Mm-hmm.
She wears a dress that's very medieval looking.
Yeah.
One of my guesses is because... The Victorian period was a lot more rigid in the values and structure and things like that, and especially for gender roles.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was partly my guess for why he chose that, because you would have been a lot more limited as a woman in the Victorian period.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, women had a lot of options than people realize in the Victorian period, especially in the late Victorian period, but that's besides the point. But the gender roles were definitely very specific, and as a woman in a foreign country, you would have been very, very limited, which Viola is, which makes some sense to her choosing to dress up as a man. And that is also true to the Shakespearean period. That is, in the original play, she has to take on the role of a man to survive.
Okay.
It doesn't really talk about it, but that is the idea.
Yeah.
But the other idea I had was, I think part of the reason why he might have chosen the Victorian period is because in the Victorian period, they had very specific traditions in regards to mourning. which we talked about a bit with Nicholas Nickleby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so because the story deals with grief a lot, especially with Olivia, I think it was a way to lean into that a bit.
Okay, that makes sense.
With the mourning.
Mm-hmm.
That was my guess, though.
At this point, we're just kind of both guessing.
Which happens. We're not professionals. I didn't interview Trevor Nunn. I'd be curious to know why. But, yeah, no, it was good. We should probably just jump into the changes and we can talk about it. All right, so some of the changes. We already said that the film opens with Feste narrating, and you get to see the shipwreck. The film opens with a masquerade on an ocean vessel in a storm. And you see a weird kind of performance that Sebastian and Viola are having, where they're trying to figure out who's who.
Yeah.
And it's played for comedy, but also opens it up to the audience, this idea of how much they look alike.
Yeah.
Which I think was clever. And so then you get to see as an audience that the ship actually sinks and that there's chaos, and you get to actually feel the tragedy of the siblings losing each other.
Correct. Yeah.
But you do get to see in the opening, you get to see that the captain of the ship is Antonio.
Oh, that's true.
Which is a big change.
Yeah.
I think the film leans a little bit into the homoeroticism of Antonio. Just in the way that, like, he really looks at Sebastian at the beginning, and the way that he acts with him. And then the way that Trevor Nunn chose to show Antonio leaving in the end. Mm-hmm. It just felt very much like, in my opinion, it felt like he went the direction of, if I can't be a part of his life, then I'm not going to be here.
Mm.
Whereas in the play, I felt it was more of Antonio was always going to be a part of his life because they're friends now.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know. That seemed the way that it was. Because there was a weird part in the beginning where they're performing and then, like, Antonio was just, like, staring at him with, like, a very specific look on his face. And it looked like it could have been angry, but also looked like it could have been, like, lecherous.
Interesting.
And I don't know. It was a little weird.
Huh.
But that was another big change, because in the original play we said, you know, Antonio was a pirate and now he's just a regular captain.
Yeah.
But he wasn't their captain on the ship that sank.
Whereas
in this version, he's that captain. Which is why I think they streamline a lot for that reason. And we already said that Viola and the other survivors, and we actually get to see the other survivors in this one, hail from a place called Messaline, which is not in the original play. And when they end up in Illyria, they're forced to hide and live like fugitives, since Messaline with this country is at war, they say, over some trading disputes. The captain mentions... Oh, that was confusing also. Because I guess it was like there was the captain with her.
Oh, yeah, later on.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know. Antonio was on the ship, though, so that's all I know. Mm-hmm. So the captain mentions the war between the merchants here and ours while hiding in the cave from Orsino and his men. Which, again, was added in, the soldiers coming and looking. In the original play, the captain claims to have been bred and born not 3 hours' travel from where they got washed ashore. And the conflict's not mentioned again in the film, although it could be connected later, as we talked about, with Antonio. And in the film, you actually get to see the captain at the very end at the party when everything's resolved.
Okay.
Other than that, the film also opens with Viola on the beach and everything, and her decision to become disguised as a man. And then it moves on to Duke Orsino.
Oh, okay.
And it shows Viola there playing the piano for him. Whereas in the play, it actually opens with Duke Orsino. The Duke Orsino. And so Viola's not there playing the music or anything. She shows up after that scene.
I did not catch that.
Yeah. You know the whole bit of if music be the fruit of love, play on? So that is the opening of the play.
That's right.
But they changed it and they messed with the timeline a little bit in the film so that when he has that dialogue, she's already there and a part of his like entourage.
I do remember that scene in the movie.
Which I think was a good choice. Because... I definitely think they lean into Viola being the main character for this film.
Yeah. No, they do.
Yeah. Which is fine. And you can jump in with any changes you have too. A lot of it was just dialogue changes. A lot of the funny bits were pulled out.
Yeah.
There's a lot of parts where dialogue was just really funny And then they just jumped to the funny bit. They got rid of the funny bits and went to the dramatic bits, you know?
Yeah. I don't remember, to be honest, I don't remember that many changes except the stuff in the end.
Well, when Antonio and Sebastian show up when they do about around midway point, they have a couple of scenes, little interludes, where it shows Antonio out and about in disguise as a priest.
Oh.
Yeah, in the little town.
Yeah.
And then the soldiers like going after him and chasing him and stuff, which adds to the conflict. And
I just assumed it was done because they had a bigger budget. But it was a movie. And
but it fleshes out the context, it does, right? Because you don't see that in the play.
No, no.
The soldiers just appear later on and arrest him. But I think Mariah was a lot less funny as well, which I thought was a shame. Because Mariah is my favorite character in the Globe version. She had some really funny lines that almost didn't even need to be funny.
Yeah.
Just the way that he says the dialogue is so funny.
Yeah.
And in the film, it was just so matter of fact.
Yeah.
Like, one of my favorite parts is when, in the play, when they've tricked Malvolio into acting and dressing in a way that Olivia hates, just to pull a prank on him. When it has Olivia coming out for like a little picnic or something in the play, she's like acting all tragic and over the top. And she's like, "Where's Malvolio? Like, his personality, basically." She's like, "His personality is perfect for the way that I feel, you know, like
he's so down.
Yes.
So negative."
And she's like, "Where is Malvolio?" And then Mariah goes, "He's coming."
I think for me, my favorite line with her too is, she mentions getting married.
Yes. So that was different in the Globe version. That was a difference.
It was.
Because in the play, in the original play, Mariah is not there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Mariah, at that part near the end, when they talk about how Mariah and Sir Toby got married, both of them are not there. Like they're not in that scene. But for the Globe version, they added them in.
Oh, okay.
And so there's a part where they say, "And Mariah and Sir Toby recently have got married," or something. And then she just looks at everybody and they all look at her and she's like, "Hooray!"
That was funny. That was well done.
There were some ad libs that you could tell they did. I think the other really funny part they definitely lean into the comedy with Olivia in the Globe version. With like the way she walks and like she glides, across the floor. And then when Sir Toby and Sebastian are fighting, she comes out with the huge halberd.
Yeah.
And then she goes over and just like makes out with him.
Yes. Yes. They did miss a lot of was a lot more serious in the movie.
And then she's like, "Come, won't you please lord over me?" And he's like, "Okay." And she's like, "Oh."
Yeah. No, it was well done. Both of them were, but in different ways.
"Take this ring and take it to the young man. I don't want, like, I think, and then if he says anything, go, kid!" Yeah. A lot of that was missing. And like I said, I think Trevor Nunn really just wanted to lean into the drama and the tragedy that the characters are feeling.
Yeah.
He definitely includes scenes where characters like Viola or whoever are out staring out at the sea or things like that.
Yeah. I think, too, that when a comedy is made for the stage, it doesn't necessarily translate to film as easily. It can be flat, is what I mean. It can. And 'cause I've seen numerous plays or musicals where they're great on the stage, they're hits, and then they make them into a movie, and you're like, ooh.
Yeah, and I think that's sometimes how you have to understand the medium, and you have to be able to adjust accordingly.
And that's what I think he did with this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, oddly enough, he reduced some of the homoeroticism of the play.
Interesting.
Besides the Antonio bit, which was a bit more suggestive than in your face, I think he actually eliminated some of it that you do see in the Globe version a little bit. Like when Viola as Cesario is with the Duke Orsino.
Oh, yes.
And Hefeste's singing to them.
I remember that.
In the Globe version, it's like really, it's like comedic, but it's like really funny how like he'll like aggressively like go to grab the arm or something. And it's like, making moves on each other. But it was definitely much more romantic in the film version, but it didn't feel as awkward, and I don't know if that was just because she was clearly a woman. But it seems like they eliminated certain moments where it could have been construed a certain way. Tell me what you think of this. I come across many sources talking about when the Duke, at the very end, when he finds out that Viola is a woman. In the dialogue, he continues to call her Cesario. And he says something like, Cesario, come to me and whatever, for I shall continue to call you Cesario while, and it, for lack of, for translation, he says, while in these clothes or like under this guise, I will continue to call you Cesario until you are dressed differently. I just took that as he would have been uncomfortable to call her a woman when she looks like a man, even though he knows she's a woman.
Yeah.
But a lot of people have taken that as he partly likes her because he thought she was a guy. So, like, part of him likes that. I definitely come across people who have tried to say things like these characters are bisexual. But I think that's a little much. But
yeah, I think it's more the idea of that's what he was used to. And when he saw that, so just automatically try to retranslate that in his head. It's... He's like, nah, this is what I know you as when you're dressed like this, so this is what I'm going to call you, you know? And it's, but once you do change, then we'll move on from there. I think beyond that, reading too much into that is definitely applying too much of contemporary thought back into Shakespearean. Because if anything, they dealt with those things in different ways.
It's also tough because sometimes somebody writes a joke just for the purpose of a joke.
Correct.
And again, I don't know what his intentions were. But like if somebody had written a joke about how blank slate. I'm writing a play. And Viola all of a sudden tells everybody that she's a woman.
Yeah.
And then like as a joke, you write in that the Duke says, "Can I just keep calling you Cesario?" But then like that's it. Like that's the end of the joke. People are going to look into that, but the original intention might have just been as a joke.
Correct. Yeah.
So we don't know, but I know that is a thing, and a lot of people just like to go crazy on those things, but I don't know.
I'm not real familiar with how homoeroticism was written in that era, but I'm a little more familiar with how it was done in the Greek era. So
it definitely existed. But it's also difficult to know how much of it was meant just to be funny.
Yes, and that's the one thing where up until, maybe the 80s, 90s maybe, a lot of this was done as humor. And so to take something from the 2000s and on and try to reapply it to the everything that was for thousands of years prior of the way we looked at humor, I think is the penchant for people today to overanalyze.
Well, and it's like you were saying, it's definitely been a trope for a very long time. You've seen movies where, like, a man is in disguise as a woman or a woman is in disguise as a man, and then there's comedy because they start falling in love with each other, and then they're, like, weirded out about it. And the way that I've looked at it, because I've seen a lot of movies that have done that, you know, some are better than others, but the way that I've always looked at it, and I think some of my friends and family are on the same page, is that in the end, they're happy to be with each other because they were attracted to them, but they were attracted to them because a part of them realized that they were the other gender, like all along almost. Like they were attracted to that in them. And that was just my way of thinking about it, and, you know, a part of that trope.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
So, no, I think I agree. I agree with you because I think oftentimes we're attracted to... It's the personality that comes around. And it happens even in the same sex where you're... I've seen this happen in real life and I've read stories and other things where you know the two people are attracted to each other but you can't figure out why. And off face value, I see the two characters, they look at in the story, they're looking at each other or you're watching them as the reader and it's like, well, they have nothing in common. Only to find out later that there's some underlying personality aspect that never has come out, because maybe the female saw him only as a friend and was afraid to, and you know, he wasn't her type or whatnot, but there was something drawn there. And so I think when you do the whole gender kind of hiding one gender swap and all that other stuff, without having to go immediately to where, I think, once again, it's to automatically go to the kind of way we look at gender today, relationships, gender identity stuff.
Definitely the way that the left looks at it.
Correct. It's very much simplistic. Whereas I think a good author is able to take these things, not explain a lot of stuff, and play with either humor, play with the drama, play with whatever it is that they're aiming for, without actually throwing it in your face and saying, this is exactly what I'm telling you about. Let's just have fun. Let's just enjoy this story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why I said there's a lot to talk about with this play.
I know.
Well, mm-hmm. Any other changes you want to talk about that you remember? No?
Not that I can think of.
So which one do you like more? Or does it depend on your mood?
I think it would depend on my mood. Mm-hmm. I think if I wanted to watch a drama, mm-hmm. a romantic drama kind of, mm-hmm. I would probably do that, the 96 version.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, but I know I definitely really enjoyed the play, the Globe version, more than I thought I would. And for a piece of, for a comedy that is cultural, that adds to the, you know, my interest in Shakespeare, it would be something I wouldn't mind putting on again and watching.
All right, so on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the best, mm-hmm. What would you rate each of these?
So having had some even more time from the last time we recorded and from watching it, I think with the play, I would give the Globe version probably an 8.5.
Okay.
Yeah. And the movie, probably an 8.
Okay.
I would say, because for looking at all the Shakespeare stuff, like, I'm tired of Romeo and Juliet. I mean, I know we're going to do it, but not that I'm tired of it, but it's been done. And some of the other stuff.
Yeah, I would say it's the most popular, it's the most common, and it's a little overdone, yeah.
Yes. And then, why can't I remember it?
What?
What was the last Shakespeare podcast we did?
Much Ado About Nothing.
Much Ado About Nothing. Yeah, I liked it, but I think this one was better.
Yeah, well, this one has more depth.
Yes. Yeah.
And the other one is very, very uplifting, even when it's a little sad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, it's always fun.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this one, and like I was saying in the analysis that person had, was it starts with grief, and the grief is kind of like an underlying base.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why in the end, you're so happy that Viola and Sebastian have found each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because at least their grief has ended.
Mm. Okay. But I think I would be more inclined to rewatch this production and this movie than I would Much Ado About Nothing.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I've watched Much Ado About Nothing a lot, so. I think I might agree with your vote. I think I might actually take the same points. I think that the 96 version is more rewatchable.
Mm-hmm.
Oddly enough, it's not as fun, but I think it is a little bit more rewatchable for whatever reason.
No, I agree, because it has the movie quality,
right?
And so I think with the play, you actually have to sit and watch it with
you
the
have movie. To pay attention, you have to listen and take it in, and but they do a great job.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So I think I'll just go with your points, because I agree with them. And so I already said my favorite character in the Globe version was Mariah.
Mm-hmm. Mine, I remember, I really liked Feste.
Okay. In the Globe version?
The Globe version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about in the 96 version?
I'm trying to remember who I liked.
You're like, they were all so boring.
No, they weren't, but I they didn't really stand out as much in my mind.
Oh, well, real quick, I was thinking, I said this last time, so I should say it now. Because the film version in the 96 version, they dramatized a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
It made the humiliation against Malvolio much more serious.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that I actually felt kind of bad for him.
I did, too. Yeah.
And I was like, ooh, just let him go.
Yeah.
But in the stage version, it's just funny.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a little much. And so, like, I think I think it's, they do make a point in saying you were very unjustly used, misused, like mm-hmm. you, like they do make a point of saying this was too much, like this was too far.
Yeah.
In the play, but because it, the Globe version leans into the comedy, it's not as serious.
Mm.
And so you don't feel as bad, mm-hmm. but the film version, I was like, ooh, this is really kind of far, like I feel really bad.
And then a whole staff there and all that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't know who my favorite in the movie would be.
I think my favorite would be Antonio in the film.
Okay.
Because I've said this before, but I really like characters that are loyal,
mm-hmm.
especially like among men. I really like that brotherly, like brothers in arms, kind of like loyalty to the end kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is why I didn't like in the end that he just leaves. Like mm-hmm. I was always really bothered by that in the end. I was like, why is he leaving? Like,
yeah.
Like, it's such a choice by the director to have him, like, because he shows every character who leaves. So he shows Mariah and Toby leaving on the
coach.
Thank you, the coach.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows Sir Andrew leaving mm-hmm. by himself in humiliation. And it shows Malvolio leaving as well in humiliation. And then it shows, I think Antonio was one of the first ones you see leave. And the way he leaves, it just kind of, for me, it had this feeling of, well, what now? Like, what am I doing now?
Mm-hmm.
I just felt really bad for him.
Hmm.
And I felt like that had to have been a directing choice.
Yeah.
And I don't know why he did that. And that's why I think the director might have leaned a little bit into Antonio in the film version having a thing for Sebastian.
No, I that makes more sense, yeah.
Because in the stage version, you don't really get that impression
mm-hmm.
about him leaving in the end. But anyways, so I think it would be Antonio for me. And if not Antonio, then it would definitely be Viola. Because I love how Imogene Stubbs played her.
I was leaning in that direction. I wasn't 100% sure, but...
And she's relatively convincing as a man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's funny.
Because sometimes you watch these things, even on stage, and you're like, eh.
Yeah, I know.
I'll just go with it. But sometimes you watch it and you're like, okay, yeah, you okay? Yeah, you're passable. You're a little effeminate man, but you're passable. I can see that.
Oh, yeah. When they're like, hello, hey, yes, and they're overdoing it. Mm-hmm. That can add to the comedy as well. You know what? I'm going to have to go with you on that one. Because I otherwise, none of the other characters... She was in my mind. Because my second choice in the Globe version, of course, is the... why can't I think of names for now? The maid.
Mariah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The one I picked.
The one you picked.
Got it.
That would have been my second choice. And so on this one, yeah, I'll go with you on that one.
Cause... Another big change in the film version is it hints that Feste knows who she is the whole time.
Yes, I remember.
Because in the beginning when she changes, she like gives up a necklace that she was wearing while on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, when they're at the party, he gives her that necklace back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then there's just moments where it had been in the directing choices where it kind of hints that he knows more than he lets on,
mm-hmm.
which is not the case in the play.
Yeah.
They definitely try to make him a bit more wise for the film.
Mm-hmm. No, he is the overarching, the all-knowing narrator, if you will. Yeah.
But because they've like made it so serious and like you said, he was a little flat.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of his comedy fell flat too.
It did.
Cause in the play, he's very clever and witty, but a lot of that's in how you say the lines.
Correct. Yes.
And so like in the play, he says things like, you know, like, take away the fool.
Mm-hmm.
When Olivia sees him, she says, take the fool away. And then he says, he's like, okay, you heard her, gentlemen. Take her away. And she's like, I told them to take away you. And then he does the whole thing where he's like, I can convince you that you're the fool.
Mm-hmm.
And then he does the whole bit where he says, so your brother's in hell, huh? And she's like, I know he's in heaven. He's like, well, if he's in heaven, then you shouldn't be mourning because it should be happy because he's in a better place. But you're clearly mourning, so you must be a fool.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, take away the fool. And like, and the way he says it, like, it's funny. It's like, you know? And there's a line later on where Viola as Cesario comes across him, and she says, where do you live by or something?
Oh, yeah.
And then he says, I live by the church.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, you're a clergyman. He's like, no, I live 100 feet from the church. Like, so I live by the church. And then so like they have a whole interaction, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the film, it fell so flat, and it was like, he's like, I live by the church. And like, oh, you're a clergyman? No, I live by the church. I live close to the church. They're like, okay.
Yeah, that's, I agree with you. I was a bit disappointed in the way his character
came off. Just don't view Ben Kingsley as a funny character. Like, in general. Like, I can't think of a movie I've seen him in where he's been funny.
It was a interesting casting, to say at least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why I think they leaned more into, like,
The wise man
for that character. Instead of just, like, the comedic traveling fool, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
So did
I. Obviously, I recommended it, but...
Yes, you did.
I'm glad you watched them.
No, I'm glad we did it. I'm really hoping, as we continue on, to get more Shakespeare.
Oh, we'll get more Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. I'm enjoying most 99% of your suggestions.
Oh, no. All right, is there anything else that you want to talk about?
No, that's about it for me.
Tune in next time for our next episode, because we are going to talk about She's the Man.
Correct.
For those out there who don't know, She's the Man, the movie with Amanda Bynes.
Correct.
Is inspired by Twelfth Night. And for the fun of it, we decided to talk about it as an adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot to talk about.
Yes, we do.
It's quite fun. And you liked it more than you thought you would.
I did.
All right. Thank you again for listening out there, everybody.
Yes, thank you, everyone.
And if you had stuff you want to contribute to the conversation, please hit us up. Just leave us a comment. Send us an email. Mm-hmm. All of that jazz.
And join us next time.
On Willing to Adapt.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Willing to Adapt.
Please follow or subscribe. Maybe leave a review or just share us with friends and family.
We would also like it if you would follow us on social media.
If you have ideas for future episodes for us, please email us at ericandromy@willingtoadapt.com.
That's Romy with an I.
And remember, when the only thing constant in life is change, be willing to adapt.